Welcome to Call Special Sauce. I'm Ed Levine. This week, another chance for you, our loyal podcast listeners, to ask questions of me and our brilliant Serious Eats Food Lab columnist and best-selling New York Times author, Kenji Lopez-Ault. Our motto is, what Kenji cannot answer is probably unknowable, though I will not resist throwing in my two spoonsful just to throw him off balance. Many of you have already emailed questions to specialsauce@serioseats.com. We welcome them anytime you happen to be listening. But Kenji, it's time for our first caller. Is it really from Cyprus?
Yeah, it's from Cyprus.
Wow. We are honored that you are calling in to call Special Sauce.
No, I'm honored that you are having me.
What's your name?
I'm Michalis, but you can call me Mike if you can pronounce it.
Okay.
I think we can do Michalis.
So I'm Greek, actually.
Okay.
And I moved in Cyprus because my wife is from here.
Okay.
So instead of, apart from cooking, I love sailing.
Right.
And the major problem that you have in sailboats is that you cannot have the food you want and the utensils you want and the port you want, etc.
Right.
So if you have to go for a vacation for 2 weeks on Greek islands, what would you take with you?
A two-week vacation on a sailboat around the Greek island. This sounds horrible.
Okay, your problem, Mike, is that you love to sail and you want to know what to put in your very, very limited space pantry. And this could be an interesting question because I think for Kenji, and maybe for me too, we can't imagine deciding to do that.
Well, I was going to say it sounds kind of like cooking out of a New York apartment kitchen.
Right.
So let's get a few more details. You're going to be sailing every day and cooking every meal on the boat?
No. You will be sailing every day, but I think once per day we will have to eat on the boat. Also breakfast, but breakfast is like a snack, let's say.
Right. So you can stop and pick up some fresh vegetables and fresh seafood and things like that each day.
Yeah, you can also fish, and you can get there are plenty of octopi in Greek islands.
Ooh, you would dive for the octopi, or you buy them?
No, you dive with a spear gun.
Oh wow, that's exciting!
It's pretty common in Greece.
Got it. How much space do you have for equipment?
I barely fit in the kitchen. You have something like 4 square feet.
Okay, just standing space. There. Yeah. And then what's your cooking setup?
And you have
like?
Only two burners, gas burners, of course,
okay.
Only one oven. I usually take my immersion circulator because it's pretty handy.
Your immersion circulator.
Yeah. If you
got it. So
sink.
Two burners and an oven and an immersion circulator. Right. Sounds like a pretty well-equipped kitchen so far. You have like plenty of like hot water and fresh water?
No. Fresh water is a luxury.
Got it.
You actually have a very, very small fridge, no freezer.
A small fridge, no freezer.
Mm-hmm.
Got it.
And the water, let's say 5 to 10 liters per day maximum.
So do you want to divide this into equipment and pantry things that you might bring? Does that work out, do you think?
Yeah, something like that. We usually eat tuna that we catch. We eat it raw,
raw tuna.
Yeah, like a sushi or poke or whatever.
What are you calling us for? It sounds like you have the perfect setup here. Fresh octopus, fresh tuna, full kitchen. So let's start with the pantry. I guess because you're in, I have quite a few friends from Cyprus. So I could tell you the first two most important things you're going to bring with you are extra virgin olive oil and lemons.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's going to go on almost everything, right? Do you have a grill? Can you like a grill out on the deck of the sailboat?
Not, I haven't tried it, but most people say it's pretty
dangerous.
Dangerous, yes.
Yeah, it sounds dangerous. Mm-hmm. So I would do extra virgin olive oil, lemon, salt, and pepper. I mean, I think I would keep it simple with just those four things. You can make almost anything taste delicious.
Okay.
As far as cooking goes, I mean, you have a stovetop, you have an oven, you have your immersion circulator. You know what? This reminds me. So a few months back, my wife and I started keeping, well, really me. I started making my wife fill out this list that I had, that we kept pinned to our refrigerator, where every time we used a piece of kitchen equipment, whatever it was, any kind of gadget or any kind of electrical appliance, we would put a little tick mark on this sheet of paper in the on the kitchen fridge. And that way we could keep track of what we actually used and what was kind of just decorating the kitchen.
Okay, that's weird. Can I just say that's weird?
No, I love it. I love it.
How much time do you have before you go sailing?
No, I will go in the summer. Don't worry.
Going in the summer. Okay, so I would maybe suggest doing that and actually seeing what you use most, because that's going to be a good indication, I think, of what you should bring. I could tell you if it was in our kitchen, based on our kitchen list, it would have been a hand blender. Which I think is actually pretty ideal for a boat setup because it's really small and it's very, very versatile. You know, you can use it to blend soups, to make sauces, to make smoothies. Like, you know, anything you can do in a regular blender, you can do reasonably well with a hand blender with a lot less space. One good knife and a cutting board.
Yep.
One really good wooden spoon, like your favorite wooden spoon, just the one utensil you're going to need basically for everything, stirring and scraping and flipping and everything. And then if it was us, it would have also been and this is the weird one, would be our number one most used piece of kitchen equipment is a tea maker, like an electric kettle that automatically makes your tea for you, which is probably too much of a luxury for a boat.
What about pots and pans, Kenji? Like, would it be like one cast iron?
Definitely either one cast iron or one carbon steel skillet, because they're going to be a little bit lighter and easier to handle on a boat, I think. But
also in Cyprus, I cannot find cast iron anywhere. Okay, I never even tried one.
Really? Wow. Yeah, I guess that's a pretty American thing, right? That kind of cast iron.
And then something to make either rice or pasta.
Well, is there electricity on the boat?
Yeah, there is, but it's pretty limited.
Pretty limited.
We actually prefer to use the gas stove.
Got it. Okay. Well, I would actually bring a pressure cooker.
Okay.
Because a pressure cooker is going to be great. I mean, you can use it as a pot, but then for things, you said you're going to be catching octopus, and the pressure cooker is like the ideal way to cook octopus. Because you know how octopus is very, very tough, right? Unless you cook it for a long time.
Yeah, actually, the main problem we have with octopus is when you catch it, you actually have to heat it. We do it in Greece. I don't know. In Japan, I think they must have it. you have to heat it for 40 times.
Right, to tenderize it.
Yeah, tenderize it by heating it on the rock.
Yeah. Back when I lived in Boston, we used to order octopus from this company called, I think they were called Octopus Garden or something like that. But they had these machines where they would get the octopus and then instead of hitting it 40 times with the rock, they would put them into these sort of giant washing machines that were filled with sea brine and had and so basically you just run the octopus through a washing machine for like an hour.
Wait a minute.
How dead does, octopus. Dead
okay,
octopus.
Okay, yeah, I was gonna say, how does the octopus feel?
The octopus doesn't feel a thing because it's already dead.
All right, thank God.
I'm sure it did not appreciate being killed in the first place.
All right.
A pressure cooker, you know, because without a pressure cooker, you have to boil an octopus for a long time before it tenderizes. With a pressure cooker, and actually Daniel Gritzer, our culinary director, just did a recipe a few months ago for pressure cooked octopus, and it cuts your cooking time down to half an hour to 40 minutes or so. And on a boat, that's, I think, especially useful because it uses much less fuel, less gas and less electricity. It also uses a lot less water because if you were to boil it if you're boiling octopus for a couple hours, you're losing a lot of moisture to steam. You're going to have to, and you need a lot more moisture to start with. A pressure cooker, you only need like a couple cups of liquid, you know, like half a liter, maybe 1 liter of water in there. And that's going to be enough to build up pressure, and then you don't have to add any more water after that. If water conservation and energy conservation are goals, then I think a pressure cooker is the ideal vessel. Same for cooking anything that you're going to be cooking in a liquid. The pressure cooker is going to save you a lot of both water and energy.
So I have a couple of questions. First of all, how many people are on the boat, Michael, at any one time? You're a Greek who's now living in Cyprus. I mean, what are your go-to dishes?
Actually, We are four people as a crew, okay. But we find many of our friends in different islands.
Okay.
So I would say six is normal for a lunch.
Right.
Six, you
and,
said?
And yes. Most useful dishes are, as I said, raw tuna or poke or sushi or whatever.
Yeah.
And mostly pasta.
Tuna and pasta. Halloumi?
Yeah.
Do you get halloumi?
Halloumi, yes, of course. Actually, we take halloumi from Cyprus. Right. We give as a gift.
Right.
Neighbor boats.
We should explain what halloumi is.
Well, halloumi is a cheese from Cyprus.
Yes, which is delicious, and often people melt
fry
it.
You
or
fry it,
right?
Yeah, it's the type of cheese that you'd either fry or grill. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I don't
very
like
salty.
It fried. I prefer it grilled. It's like a mozzarella, but after you make the mozzarella, you have to boil it with salt.
Right.
To make it harder.
And that's what sort of sets the protein a little bit tighter so that it doesn't melt the way mozzarella
Michael,
does.
What about goat? Is goat your go-to item?
Goat?
Lamb, I think, right?
Lamb, right?
I think it's lamb.
we rarely eat meat on the boat.
got it.
You know, you're on the sea, you want something from the sea to eat.
You want to stay locavore.
yeah, locavore.
You've never seen those Mediterranean sea lambs?
Yeah,
exactly.
Of course. There is an island in Greece, in northern Greece, Samothraki, mm-hmm. which they take the whole goat and fill it up with rice
mm-hmm.
and put it in the wood oven. And it's a fantastic dish. It's one of the few dishes from the islands that has meat.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great.
By the way, Kenji, I know you love chickpeas.
I do love chickpeas.
There is an island in Greece that has the best chickpeas you will ever have.
Really?
I promise.
I feel like there's an island in Greece for everything. Like what? One island for each thing
really,
you could possibly want. Isn't there an island, or maybe this is a location in Cyprus where they say there's some kind of optical illusion where it makes it look like things are rolling uphill?
Oh, that's a hill in Athens.
Oh, it's a hill in Athens. Okay.
So do you, Michael, go from island to island when you sail?
Yeah, of course. That's the point.
Yeah. You mean I'm a dope that I even asked you that question?
There are so many islands that are pretty close. So the point of sailing in Greece is to, you know, go from island to island.
And sometimes you eat in restaurants, and sometimes you eat on the boat.
Yeah, every night we eat in restaurants.
Got it. Great.
You know, because we want to drink ouzo, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot be on the boat and be drunk, you know.
Right.
It's
exactly.
A good combination.
Well, mm-hmm. Michael, thank you so much for calling all the way from Cyprus. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, thanks for calling.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoy your sailing.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Have you been to Greece?
I have not been to Greece, and I feel like that is – I mean, you're much better travel than I am just in general, although I hope to remedy that in the coming years.
Yeah, I mean, my only experience – so, I mean, I have a ton of Greek friends, many of whom you've met, and Cypriot friends. But I've actually only been to Greece once. I think I've only pseudo been to Greece because it was on like one of those island hopping cruises when I was, I don't know, high school. My mom really wanted to go on a cruise to the Greek islands. So we were cruising around the islands and spending maybe 3 hours a day in various cities on each island. So most, like 90% of the time was spent on a boat, which is, to me, it's not the ideal way to travel. I mean, a boat is a great way to travel,
right.
But not actually spending time with a tour group instead of with
So you
locals.
Would like to go back to Greece then, too?
Oh, I would. Yeah, I would love to go back to Greece. And I would especially love to spend some time in Cyprus. You remember my friend Stefanos?
Yeah.
Too? Yeah,
he's a good dude.
He moved back to Cyprus, still, I think, to live with his mom because she feeds him and he's living the good life out
did
there
now. Did he ever turn you on to Cypriot dishes?
You know, well, when we were talking to that caller, I said, you know, olive oil and lemon. So whenever Stefanos cooked, that was it.
That was it.
Grilled fish or grilled meat, olive oil, lemon, you know, really simple, but really good food.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you have fresh seafood, you don't really need much else than that.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like Greek food in general is in a way a first cousin of Italian food in that it's super
Mediterranean.
Not a lot of ingredients,
yeah.
Very simple preparation. It all depends on the freshness of the ingredients.
Yeah, and I think because of that, it often gets misrepresented in the U.S. because most of the time when you're buying Greek food, it's like stuff that's sitting behind a display case in a deli or something like that.
Right.
As opposed to Italian food, which most of the time you get it in the States is, well, it's either Italian-American, but if it's real Italian food, you're getting it freshly
yes.
made for you. Yeah, I don't think I even knew what Greek food was until I started meeting all these people from Greece.
Right, and, like, and Greek restaurants.
Oh, it's not just like reheated moussaka.
Right. I think the gyro became Greek food for many of us in in the States, which is a little scary, or souvlaki.
Souvlaki, yeah.
Well, now, you know, I mean, Kenji, you know.
Or the iceberg Greek salad.
Yeah, but there's now serious Greek cooking going on in restaurants.
Yeah, we're like four or five blocks away from Kefi right here.
Right.
Which is
which is
Greek cooking.
Right. And there's Molivos and in other cities in Chicago and San Francisco and L.A., there's lots of interesting either Greek food or Greek-inspired food.
Mm-hmm.
People always talk about it. Oh, it's going to be the next discovered cuisine, but somehow it's never made it to that.
What is the next discovered cuisine, you think?
There's a lot of talk about Scandinavian food, but I don't really see that happening.
Becoming super mainstream.
Yeah.
It's super popular with chefs. I don't think it's going to trickle down to home cooks, especially because I think the parts of it that chefs are interested in is very, very terroir-based.
Right.
It's stuff that's very essential to Scandinavia.
Right.
And it's not easy to find those ingredients or to apply that kind of technique or thinking.
Right.
To,
yeah. Because it's like,
cooking.
It's like, it's all those things that they find in the woods. Right.
Right.
It's like, what is that?
Nobody's going to be making like a lichen and fir tree and reindeer stew at home.
We are not going to get any calls. Or it's like, I have 2 pounds of lichen. How do I keep crispy? We're doing Call Special Sauce again with Kenji Lopez-Alt in the studio, which is kind of awesome because he's usually 3,000 miles away. And we have a call from Kevin, I believe. Kevin, what's up?
Hey, how's it going?
Good, man.
How's it going with you?
Things are good. I'm in D.C. It's a busy day over here, but I'm happy to call in. I'm a big fan.
Oh, well, thank you very much. We like big fans. Very important to us to have big fans.
Huge fans.
Yeah, it's huge fans, exactly. What's your question, Kevin?
Why is it that a marinade only penetrates a few millimeters into meat, like, say, you know, for fajitas,
right,
while a brine, like in buttermilk for fried chicken, like I was saying, does seem to penetrate the meat and actually make for a more tender, juicy final product?
Got it. Okay, so why do marinades only penetrate a little bit while brines penetrate a lot?
Yeah.
So when you're talking about a marinade, you're talking about – so you mentioned fajitas. So that'll be something like there'll be some maybe chilies in there. And in many U.S.-based recipes, there'll be some soy sauce and probably some lime juice and a little bit of oil and kind of all whisked together with maybe some other spices and seasonings. And then you put the meat in that. And it's true. If you can leave meat sitting in a marinade like that overnight, and by the next day, if you cut into it, you'll see that it's really only penetrated a couple of millimeters, and it's not just the color, actually. It's the flavor too. Back when I worked at Cooks Illustrated, I did this whole series of tests on different types of marinades to see how well they were penetrating to things. And when I did those tests, I marinated a bunch of meat in different marinades overnight, then cooked them the next day, and then shaved very carefully. Used a knife to shave off the outer layers a bit at a time. And then had people taste them and I shaved off more and more until tasters could no longer tell the difference between a piece of meat that was marinated and a piece of meat that was unmarinated. And you find that even that the flavor, really only penetrates a couple millimeters per day that it spends in the marinade. But on the other hand, you're absolutely right that something in a brine, which is like a very salty solution, that solution is going to penetrate into the meat actually relatively quickly. A chicken breast that you put into a brine, you're going to see results that make it juicier all the way to the center, even within, a couple hours. Kevin, your question is why the difference between these two things?
Yes, that, and I'm also wondering, like, you know, so I get, you know, sometimes you'll be doing a brine that's just, say, salt and sugar.
Mm-hmm.
But then sometimes, you know, you're also doing a brine in, say, something like buttermilk. And so I was wondering if, you know, what the base liquid is, if that matters as well.
Got it. Well, so to answer the question of the penetration, the chemical formula for table salt?
Yeah. Sodium chloride.
Yeah. Easy. All right. Now give me the chemical formula for the main flavoring in garlic.
Nope.
No. It's a big, long thing. It's a much larger molecule. So it's this big long thing, and most volatile aromatic compounds that you know that derive from natural sources, they're all these sort of larger molecules. You know, sodium is small, and these other ones are much larger, and so it's actually much more difficult to get them into meat. These larger aromatic compounds, it's much more difficult to get them into meat than it is to get salt into meat. So that's really the main reason is that, you know, so when you have a salty brine, it's easy for the salt to penetrate into the meat, but it's not easy for the larger aromatic compounds to penetrate into the meat. So then the question is, well, can you make a marinade and just make it really extra salty? And is that going to help some of the flavors penetrate in? And the answer there, again, and if you've tried this, you probably see. But the answer there, again, is no. What ends up happening is that the salt will selectively move into the meat as opposed to the flavorings moving in. So I kind of liken it to where do you live, Kevin?
I live in D.C.
You live in D.C. Okay. I'm not that familiar. Ed, are you familiar with D.C. public transport?
I do. I am. Yeah. I've spent a fair amount of time, as Kevin has, in the subways.
Is there anything like Grand Street Station
No,
in D.C.?
There's nothing like Grand Street Station in D.C. What Kenji is referring to is our subway stop near our current office in Chinatown, which is right below a fish market and is not really fit for human habitation.
Well, it's always packed.
Yes.
And it's packed with different types of people. So there's people coming to and from work, but then there's also all of the Chinatown shoppers, the people who are coming for their daily groceries. So it's usually, you know, they say a 60 to 80-year-old woman
with a cart that's knocked me down twice.
Yes, exactly. Carts that push you out of the way. So if you're standing on, so let's say that those women are salt molecules, and you, Ed, and you and your friends are aromatic compounds. You're garlic. When the subway pulls into the station, there's a limited, you know, the doors are small. There's a limited number of space inside. And those salt molecules, the ladies with the push carts really want to get in, and they are perfectly willing to knock you out of the way to get in there.
And
they have, and so that's what happens. So it's actually an effect called salting out. So when you have a marinade, the salt is actually going to prevent other molecules from moving into the meat because it has such a larger attraction.
So it's almost counterintuitive.
Yeah. So really, it's, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't. Like the salt is not actually going to make that much of a difference in terms of how flavor penetrates. No matter what, those larger flavor compounds are really just—they're not going to get on that subway car.
You know, that's a really good metaphor, but you haven't solved the problem of the women knocking me down. I mean, that's a really rough one. So let's get back to brining, though, because you've made me a fan of dry brining as opposed to wet brining. And I don't know, Kevin, if you've actually thought about this or experienced that.
Yeah, I do. I do both. So, you know, when I just like am making steak in an hour, you know, I'll dry brine it. But if I'm making, you know, some like fried chicken, you know, I'll brine overnight. Right.
With butter. Yeah. That you do a buttermilk brine, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that was the other side of your question. So a buttermilk brine, you say, does seem to penetrate. It's mostly the salt that's penetrating into the center. And that's actually going to make make your chicken juicier. The way a brine works, and this is whether it's a dry brine or a wet brine, the way a brine works is that the salt will dissolve some muscle proteins, mainly a protein called myosin. And if you were to picture a turkey breast or a chicken breast really up close, it consists of a bunch of these meat fibrils that are all bound together, sort of like telephone cable. And each one of those little fibrils has juice in it. And as the meat cooks, they squeeze, and it's sort of like squeezing a tube of toothpaste. You're squeezing liquid out from the ends. And so your goal when cooking is to minimize that squeezing because you want the juice to stay inside. You know, because with toothpaste, once you squeeze it out, you can't get it back into the tube. And the same thing happens with meat. So what salt does is it dissolves a protein called myosin so that when the meat subsequently cooks, it doesn't squeeze as hard, so that you end up losing less juice overall as it's cooking. And that's exactly what's happening in your buttermilk brined fried chicken. The salt is working its way in and making the center seem juicier. And then, of course, on the surface, you're also going to have some effects from, it's not going to penetrate very far, but you're going to have some effects from the acid in the marinade as well.
And so you dry brine, can you dry brine just overnight, right?
You can do it a couple nights, but yeah, generally just overnight is fine.
Well, Kevin, I hope we've answered your questions. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. Yeah.
And did we address your concerns?
Yeah, I think so. So I'll be brine in water and compare to buttermilk and see.
Yeah.
See if there's a big difference.
Yeah. In the center, there shouldn't be much difference. On the outer layers, there probably will be a difference.
Okay, interesting. Okay,
all right,
cool.
Kevin. Take care, man.
Thanks, folks. Appreciate it.
I'm Ed Levine, and I'm here with my running partner, Kenji Lopez-Alt, and you're listening to Call Special Sauce. All right, we have another call. It's Julia. Hello, Julia. Where are you calling from?
Hi. I'm actually calling from New York.
You're calling from New York. That's a very foreign place to us.
Yeah.
Are you calling from the subway?
No, I think it's just, I guess you can hear the subway wherever you go.
All right, what's your question, Julia?
So my question is, and I don't think I've heard this being asked on your show yet, but okay. I wanted to know about cooking sort of tomato sauce or acidic/tomato-y things in cast iron skillets. Because I've often seen recipes for stuff like shakshuka or quick pasta or tomato heavy recipes being cooked in cast iron. But I've always been kind of confused by that because from my understanding, cooking things that are a little bit more acidic in cast iron will make it, I think I've heard that it makes it rust faster or strip away some of the seasoning. So I was wondering if I just sort of made that up or if that sort of holds any water and what I should be doing in case I do want to maybe cook something tomatoey in
right.
a cast iron skillet.
Or like a wine sauce or something like that.
Yeah.
So do you have a cast iron skillet at home?
I do. I have a couple.
A couple. What kind of cast iron skillets? Do you know the brands?
I don't remember.
It's modern, vintage?
Mom. Yeah, it's like a little older. I don't think it's like super. It hasn't been in my family for like 3 million years, but it's a little bit older. It's
2 million
been quite
years
well something. Used. So,
and does it have? It's one of those pants, like an older, like Griswold or Wagner, where it has a very smooth bottom to it.
Yes.
Nice. So you are lucky. You are the lucky owner of good cast iron because it's hard to get good cast iron these days. And so I guess assuming that it's been in your family this long, it probably is pretty well seasoned. Also, then.
It's not like one that I've had for, generations, but it's definitely been well used. My mom cooks a lot, and so I sort of have that, sort of inherited it from her.
Can you fry an egg in it?
Yes.
And the egg, does it stick?
No, I don't think so.
The egg just kind of slides around?
Yeah.
Okay, man. Okay, so you are definitely in good shape cast iron wise. So I mean, the main reason I'm asking those questions is because I want to get a handle of actually how well seasoned your pan is. And you know, if you don't know what seasoning is, just for listeners, so the seasoning on your cast iron pan is it's a layer of polymers that build up on the surface of cast iron as you cook fats in it. So a lot of people, and I had this perception for a long time too. I always thought that seasoning was oil seeping into the pores of the iron and kind of smoothing it out.
That's what I always thought.
Yeah, that's what I learned when I was younger, but that's actually not the case. It's actually the polymerization of oil. So you're taking an oil and through heat turning it into a form of plastic, actually a polymer.
You once told me that it was nature's Teflon.
Yes, seasoning is nature's Teflon. Yeah, so the more layers of oil and the more times you heat the pan and let that oil polymerize, the better and better your seasoning becomes, and eventually you'll have something that is non-stick enough to cook eggs in it, like your pan. So the thing is, once you have a really nice layer of seasoning built up. Polymers don't react to things the same way that oils do. So people will say don't wash your cast iron pan with soap because it's going to strip away the seasoning. Oil, like I said, polymers actually don't respond to soap the way that oil does. So soap will take away oil. It's a surfactant that will take away oil, but it won't take away any seasoning. The seasoning stays just fine.
Sure.
And similarly, if your pan is well seasoned, an acidic tomato sauce is also not going to take it away. Have you ever tried cooking a tomato sauce in it?
I've made. I've been a little bit apprehensive about making it just because of that sort of notion, but uh-huh. I've made shakshuka in a smaller cast iron pan before, and I've made, I think, yeah, that was mostly it. I'm a big fan of baked eggs, so I tend to use that in a cast iron a lot. Any other uses would just be for, like, normal steaks and...
Right.
So what have you found out? Has the shakshuka worked in the smaller cast iron pan? Because I think Kenji's just given you license now that he has he officially sanctioned your cast iron pan, and it's worthy of shakshuka, and it's able to withstand shakshuka.
Yeah, I mean, did you notice any kind of off flavors? So one of the things that could happen with an unseasoned pan is that you'll get metallic flavors. Into the food. So if you have an unseasoned Dutch cast iron Dutch oven and you simmer tomato sauce in it for a couple hours, it's going to come out tasting like iron. Did you notice anything like that when you were eating your shakshuka?
I think it was not. I don't think it was long enough for me to taste anything off. I think it was mostly because I used my like old tomato sauce, or
right.
like, you know, leftover tomato sauce and made baked eggs, and then, you know, add some more spice to it. So it was kind of like a shakshuka light.
Right.
Got it.
So it wasn't really sitting in there for a long time.
Right. And if your pan was well enough seasoned, then you probably shouldn't have tasted anything anyway. I mean, cast iron is sort of like the traditional vessel for shakshuka. I actually, you know, we published a shakshuka recipe a couple months ago on Serious Eats, and I remember one person, maybe it was on Twitter or it was online, commenting that you have to make it in cast iron because that iron imparts an essential metallic flavor to the dish. which is only true if your cast iron is not very well seasoned. I prefer it without the metallic flavor.
All right, Julia. Well, I hope we've answered your question. Keep making your shakshuka in the cast iron pan. Just be very careful because all cast iron pans are not created equal.
All right, yeah. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
You say all cast iron pans are not created equal. I'd say most cast iron pans are created equal. It's more about how you treat them after. Yeah.
Yes.
With cast iron, it's much more nurture than nature.
Yeah. That's a great lie. We should use that lie sometime.
I think we just used it.
Exactly. I'm Ed Levine, and I'm here with my running partner, Kenji Lopez-Alt. Andrew, you're on Call Special Sauce. What's up, man?
Hi, how are you?
Good.
How's it going?
Good. Freezing. So I just moved to New York from California, and like many people have a tiny pint-sized apartment. So I was just curious, do you guys have any favorite dishes for those with scaled-down kitchens?
Well, can I ask you, first of all, move from California to New York, why?
Kenji can't figure out why that's the reverse Kenji migration. He not only did he move from New York to California, but all of his friends, he moved his entire social life from New York to the Bay Area, which is really an amazing trick.
And I moved from a tiny, tiny New York City apartment kitchen to an actual decent sized kitchen because there's more space out there.
Yeah. so he's already, you know, negatively predisposed towards your question, Andrew, because of your reverse migration. But we're still going to get to your question.
All right.
It's weird because I find that the most difficult thing is we have a 4-burner stove and one oven. Mm-hmm. It's the one oven that is invariably an element of any small kitchen that I find the most difficult to deal with. So because you have to
layer, you know, like what you're cooking certain things and then reheating them. And, you know, I mean, Kenji, of course, having lived much of his life in small New York City kitchens, has also addressed this.
For me, a lot of cooking in a small New York apartment was maximizing all of my energy sources. Your New York apartment, it probably also has a microwave. It also has burners. You might also have some kind of electric appliances that you can use, like a toaster oven, something like that. This maybe comes from my restaurant days where menus are planned to sort of give you an even balance between all the different stations so that the guy on the grill doesn't just make 90% of the dishes. You know, you design menus so that you're spreading out the work among many different types of cooking. Pan roast my Brussels sprouts or maybe deep fry my Brussels sprouts in a wok. I'm going to have some dishes that I'm going to be able to make ahead and then reheat, like my mashed potatoes. I'm going to reheat them in the microwave because microwaves are great at reheating mashed potatoes. I might be making something else in the toaster oven. And that way you can get, you know, all of those things going at the same time as opposed to having to fight for space within the oven.
This is worthy of a MacArthur Foundation Genius Award. I mean, this is pretty awesome. I like this.
What part of California were you from?
I grew up in Orange County, so I grew up in Little Saigon, and then I spent the last 5 years in San Luis Obispo in the Central Coast.
Yeah. Can you give me your quick assessment of how long have you been in New York now?
So I literally just moved here like a month and a half ago.
A month and a half. Okay.
Yeah.
Can you give me your quick assessment of New York Vietnamese food versus Little Saigon, Orange County Vietnamese food?
I think that's an answer. I think that's an answer, Kenji. He's very politic, but
yes,
is that my politically correct answer?
I will say,
I do really enjoy the markets in Chinatown right now.
Yeah,
it does remind me a lot of home. The few Vietnamese restaurants I've found and been to, they're all right. They're enough to get me by.
Yeah, that's always been my sort of my impression. Like Vietnamese food in New York is one. There's a lot of great stuff in New York. It's difficult to find great Vietnamese, though.
I don't understand why that is, because there is...
I feel like there's a huge market for it, so I'm just waiting for someone to take advantage of it.
And first of all, Vietnamese cooking is one of my favorite styles of cooking. I believe there's a large enough Vietnamese population here.
There's critical mass.
But maybe I'm wrong. But I agree with you, Andrew, and I think Kenji would agree with me, that the Vietnamese restaurants and, like, our offices are in Chinatown. We're surrounded by a lot of truly mediocre Vietnamese restaurants. like two – I can't tell you one restaurant that I would recommend you go to.
Yeah. I mean, do you think part of it might be that a lot of these restaurants sprang up at a time when New Yorkers didn't necessarily know what good Vietnamese food was, and so it was sort of catering to certain local tastes, and that has just kind of stuck around? Because a lot like bad New York Chinese food, I find a lot of mediocre New York Vietnamese food to be sort of overly sweet and overly simplified.
And there was no reason to up their game.
You know, I would say so, yeah, because it's just so different growing up in California because my whole neighborhood is Vietnamese. So, I mean, I've been trying to drag my mom, who's 60 and still working the line at our restaurant, to come over and open it in New York. But, yeah, I would say so.
Oh, you guys have a restaurant there?
Sorry?
Your mom has a restaurant there, you said?
Yeah, they opened it right when they immigrated in the 70s. So that's kind of where I grew up and where my unnecessarily high standards came from, I guess.
standards are good.
High standards. We're a fan of high standards at Sirius East. And is the restaurant still open?
Yeah, it's still open. They're 60, and I'm trying to get them to retire. But
what's it called? What's it called? Because Kenji and I, we might find ourselves there. We might meet you there.
Yeah. So if you're ever in Westminster, California, it's called Pho 79.
Pho 79.
Pho 79. Yeah. That's awesome.
So way before all the pho puns were in place.
All right, Andrew. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
You're listening to Call Special Sauce with my running partner, Kenji Lopez-Alt, our managing culinary director at Sirius Eats and Food Lab columnist and best-selling New York Times.
Like blah, 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 blah.
Your bio's getting too long, dude. I'm Ed Levine, the founder of Sirius Eats, the overlord, as our first managing editor, Adam Kuban, called me. And Kenji occasionally still calls me overlord, but I think it's meant ironically.
No, I mean it with sincerity. I mean, I don't even know what the official duties of an overlord are. So
I know that's the great thing about being an overlord.
You know what new title you can add? A title that you can add to my list. This past week I was a guest on a Star Wars themed podcast. So you can add Star Wars podcaster. It was the coolest podcast I've ever been on.
Okay,
almost as cool as this one. It's called Star Wars Minute.
Okay.
And in this show, it's a couple of nerds who each episode is about 1 minute of Star Wars, and they go through every minute in all of the movies consecutively.
I was
on for a full week, and during that week, we did minutes 11 through 16 of Attack of the Clones.
That's awesome. First of all, for people who don't know, Kenji is a total Star Wars freak. So this was his idea of heaven.
Yes.
Right?
It was great. What's great about listening to it also is that you never run out of episodes.
So your new title
because each episode's like half an hour long. And so for a given episode of Star Wars, that you're talking about like 1,500 minutes of podcast or something like that. No, even longer, 4,500 minutes of podcast.
So the title we're adding is Star Wars Podcaster.
Yeah. Official Star Wars Podcast Guest. Let's say that.
Official Star Wars Podcast Guest.
You can replace all the other stuff with that.
Okay. I like that. Hello, Philip. You're on Call Special Sauce with me and Kenji Lopez-Alt. What's your question?
Hi, Ed. Hi, Kenji. Happy to be on the show.
How's it going?
Very well. I just have a quick question. So I'm in a debate with one of my roommates. He likes to cook food in an evening. He eats a bowl for dinner and leaves the rest on the stove to pack up for lunch the next day and then put in the fridge. And so I've offered advice. I'm worried about him. I don't want him to get sick. So I've used government warnings from the FDA Safe Practices Manual and published articles about exponential bacteria growth in food. And so do you have any advice as to help shape a debate with him about food safety, or am I just being overly cautious?
First, where do you live?
I'm in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Oh,
Pittsburgh,
so okay. It's not a warm weather.
This sounds
it's warm weather in July.
Yeah, yeah.
This sounds like an episode of Judge Hodgman here, John Hodgman.
It's true.
We need to I'll be Kenji Lopez Zalt, your court bailiff, and I'll rise for the Honorable Ed Levine,
exactly.
Who will render his judgment, and his judgment will be final.
Let's talk about bacteria, Kenji, and food. And as you know, I have been known to leave pizza out overnight.
You've been known to leave pizza out. You forbid anyone putting your mozzarella in the fridge.
That's true. I'm proud to say that.
You have also been known to bring back fried chicken from where? Nashville, maybe?
Yes, Nashville.
That had been I only heard after I ate it from Elena Brown. I heard that it was sitting in the back seat of the car by the back window for a good 3 days while you were driving around.
Yeah, it was because we went to Bonnaroo. Yeah, it was 3 days.
It was delicious fried chicken.
See, and Kenji's still here.
So your roommate. How many roommates do you have? First of all,
I have two roommates.
Two roommates, and you share an apartment, and you share a kitchen.
And how many did you start with, Phil?
It's been three. Okay. It's been me and the two others this entire time.
Do you share cooking equipment too? When he cooks something in his pot, does that mean that pot then cannot be used by anyone else?
So I keep all my cast iron in my room because I just don't trust him with that either. So it's all his own cooking equipment.
Are you concerned for your roommate's safety, or are you? Is this something that bothers you just on a sort of basic moral principles level? Or is it an actual sort of physical inconvenience for you?
So this is Kenji, the roommate therapist, talking now.
Oh, excellent, excellent. No longer bailiff. Excellent. it's just a matter. I don't like food sitting around because I don't think it's particularly, good to have food sitting around. That's how you get mice.
Unsanitary.
That's how you get ants. That's how you get cockroaches. But also, I mean, that's a big thing I've read about in making stews and soups. It's like if you don't just put it straight into the freezer.
Right.
Because that can warm the entire freezer up.
Right, right. You don't want to
cool
do that.
It through the danger zone is all.
Right, right. Okay, well, let's break those two things down. Do you have mice or cockroaches or rodents or ants, anything like that in your apartment?
Not at this time.
Okay. And how long has your roommate been practicing this unsafe stew making?
As long as I've known him, so about 2.5 years.
So for 2.5 years, he's been putting unsafe things out, and it has yet to attract mice, rodents, ants, insects, anything, any kind of pests. So I think we can say that particular fear is an unfounded one.
Okay.
But now let's talk about bacteria.
Right.
Yes, it's dangerous. it's as simple as that, but it's also obviously not quite that simple because, there is this notion of the danger zone. And for people who don't know what the danger zone is, it's generally defined as 40 degrees Fahrenheit to 140 degrees Fahrenheit. And what they teach you in your serve-safe classes, like restaurant certifications, is that foods should spend no longer than a total of 4 hours within those temperature ranges, 40 degrees to 140 degrees, because those are the temperature ranges at which bacteria can flourish. That is an extremely, extremely simplified version of reality. In truth, bacteria will actually stop sort of flourishing at about 130 degrees, and bacteria can actually, continue to grow at even below 40 degrees. And it's not really it's not like an on-off switch. At 40 degrees, they turn on. At 140, they turn off. It's a steady ramp up. So the warmer and warmer you get, the faster bacteria will multiply. But there's other things that affect bacterial growth as well. Mainly it's water activity, so the amount of free moisture in a food. And that can be defined by, the ratio of liquid to fat, of water-based liquid to fat, the salt content, and also sort of even the physical structure of the food itself. So something like a loaf of bread, it has water in it, but it has relatively low water activity because most of that water is bound up inside it. So that's why bread is perfectly safe to leave at room temperature, as is, well, not quite fried chicken. But fried chicken, do you know why fried chicken was, and this is actually something interesting I learned a few weeks ago, why fried chicken is typically associated with black families from the South. The reason is because back in the day, it was difficult for a black family that was traveling to get served in restaurants. And fried chicken, because it has that breaded coating and because it's fried at a very hot temperature and the outside becomes sterile, it actually is one of the foods that is actually very, very good at preserving itself.
See, I knew that when I served you the 4-day-old fried chicken.
Right. So it's a perfect food for bringing, and that's why it's popular on road trips, but it's a perfect food for bringing with you when you're not sure if you're actually going to be able to get food down the line. So something like fried chicken actually preserves very well. Stews and soups, things that are in a pot like that, not so much. Like they don't preserve quite as well because they have such high water activity. If safety is your concern, then you're probably on the right side of this debate. But do you share food with your roommate?
I do not share food.
Okay, so you're really just looking out for his health, or are you concerned that his soup is going to somehow contaminate everything else?
Well, I mean, I am looking out for his health primarily, but also I don't want my food particularly contaminated either.
Do you kill the bacteria when you do reheat it, or the bacteria? I mean, that's always a question I've had.
Yeah. So yes, bacteria can be killed by reheating, but the thing that you have to worry about is not just the bacteria itself, but toxins that bacteria can produce. So, you can take completely spoiled milk, a really rotten stew, heat it up, it will be sterile, but all of the sort of toxic byproducts that the bacteria has already produced are still going to be in there.
So it's the ultimate good news, bad news proposition.
Reheating is not sufficient to make something safe to eat. It's sufficient to make it sterile, but sterile is not really the only thing we care about. As far as, you getting sick, if you're not eating your friend's food, there's not really that much of a chance that it's going to contain, especially if you're saying that it's something he's cooking in a pot and he's putting a lid on it, there's not really a chance that it's going to contaminate much else in that kitchen. Because it's not like bacteria have wings and fly around. They can be carried by convection. They can be carried by a strong breeze, but not very far, and especially not if they're in a pot with a lid. So I wouldn't worry too much about contaminating other things. The only thing you might be worried about is if he leaves a pot on the stove overnight and then the next day puts it in the fridge and kind of sloshes it around and it gets out. That you might want to worry about a bit.
Philip, would you eat a slice of pizza that had been kept out overnight?
have done that, yes. I'll admit to that.
And Kenji, how do you feel? I mean, do you feel like that's safe if you're eating even a pepperoni slice? Because the pepperoni is cooked even before it gets on the pizza. So,
well, more importantly, pepperoni is salty.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, pizza, relatively safe. It's usually pretty salty. It's usually, you know, bread, so not much free moisture in the bread. The part you might have to worry about is the sauce and the cheese, but sauce is usually pretty acidic. Cheese that has been, well, fresh mozzarella can go bad.
Yeah, fresh mozzarella tends to get just more sour.
A little more sour. Yeah, before it'll start molding or anything like that.
I've decided that I'm willing to go 2 days before it gets too sour, and then I'm...
Then you're done.
Then I'm done. Well, anyway, Philip, I hope we've answered your question. And
yeah, I appreciate it.
And thanks a lot for calling Call Special Sauce.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you both.
That's all the time we have. Thank you, callers, for calling Call Special Sauce. I'm Ed Levine, and thank you, Kenji Lopez-Alt.
Thank you.